Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Morning. Can I check that you can hear us on Zoom, please?
I can hear you on Zoom.
Thank you
Fantastic.
very much. Okay.
Having been on the other side of Zoom for many a Sunday, I appreciate you checking.
Okay.
So happy Father's Day and happy solstice. Once upon a time, I had a Sangha member tell me, "Joshin, you always talk about somebody dying in your Dharma talk." So I'm going to start my Dharma talk off about a death. Much of my life these days revolves around sickness, old age, death, distress, shock, trauma, all the things that happened that put people in hospitals. But this first story isn't about one of my patients or one of my families. On Thursday, I got an email that was sent to a very large group of Soto Zen priests that said a friend of mine had died. So that was surprising, and that was a shock. And this was a priest who has been in a group. There's a small number of us, about four of us, who have been meeting for about 3 years. And these are Soto Zen priests who are also hospital chaplains or hospice chaplains. So we meet about once a month for peer support. And it was surprising to be at work, working with people who have had sudden health issues and receive this notice that my friend died suddenly. And watching the mind, watching what the mind does in times like that. Like, I had just told someone, "Who do you have to support you? Because you can't counsel yourself out of this. Like, this is, you need to be in the moment, be in the distress." And I found myself in that moment, in that distress. Watching the mind do the things that it tries to do to make sense when things don't make sense. "This must be a joke. Like, somebody's pulling our leg. This can't really be happening." Or maybe he's going to send an email and say, "Oh, that was a mistake. I'm still here." Like, just leaning into that magical thinking, wanting it to be otherwise. So I've sat with that shock. I've sat with that grief. I've sat with the sorrow. I think his funeral is happening right about now. So he's on my mind. So I'm starting off this talk with this story about this death. One, to check the box that says Joshin talked about death during her Dharma talk. And to bring some of my experience forward, because what I want to talk about today and what so much of the work that I do, both as a priest and as a chaplain, a lot of what I talk with people about is, how do we make sense of this human existence? How do we make sense of our experiences? How do we make sense of all of the crazy things that happen in our life in a way that catches us off guard? And why is it that these things catch us off guard? We have ideas of how the world should be. We have the ideas of how we want the world to be. We have an expectation about how our life is going to unfold. And we need these things on a certain level. We need to be able to plan for how we're going to feed ourselves next week. We need to be able to recognize, yes, I've got to go to work tomorrow. Or, hey, maybe I should actually enroll my kids in school. There's deadlines, there's things that need to be taken into account. So we need some level of future thinking. We need some level of planning to get through our lives. But then things happen that catch us off guard. And these could be things that are very deeply personal to us, that happen in our immediate life. These are things that could happen to people we know, maybe a friend who's at a distance, maybe someone we see regularly. All of a sudden, our favorite barista isn't there anymore. What happened? could be something that we encounter on the news, or we hear about third hand from someone. But there's still this sense of something changed. Life isn't the way I thought it would be. This isn't how I planned it. This isn't how I expected it to be. I think the Buddha had some teachings about that. I think our teachings of impermanence do us a great service in how we work with life. And in a way, these are the sorts of things that prompted the Buddha to do his deep search, to leave his life of privilege, to go out, to hold these questions of, I thought my life was one way, but there are these other things happening. How do I deal with that? How do I cope? What does this mean? Who am I now that I know X, Y, and Z is in the world? Impermanence, emptiness, no self. All of these things are things that we learn about, that we talk about. And we use the tool of language to communicate and try to grapple with. And language is a great tool. It forms our thoughts. It forms how we communicate with each other. It gives us sounds with which we try to communicate our experience. I was talking with a man the other day whose wife was in the midst of having a stroke. And I asked him how he was doing, and he told me all about his long drive from Eastern Oregon and how tired he was, and that now this was happening and he didn't know. And he just wanted to go into the room and see her. So we managed to get him in the room. And I said, you know, the doc told him what was going to happen next. And I said, she's going to be moved to a different room. I'll be able to take you up there. And he turns to me and he goes, I'm fine. Like, all he needed was to be in the room with his wife. After that, what I had to offer was extra. He wasn't fine. He was really upset. But in that moment of being really upset, he could not communicate to me, I'm really upset. I really just want to be here with her. That's the most important thing. All he could say was, I'm fine. That's A-okay. He was where he needed to be. She was getting the care she needed. I have no idea what happened to them next because they were off my unit at that point. I wish them the best. And I don't know. So we use words to communicate. We use words to describe our experience. We use words to shape our reality. And there's a way, like with future thinking and planning, that works for us. I think most of us have probably been talking from an early age, and it's natural we don't think about it. There's a way in which having to communicate via words adds an extra layer. It's still a conceptual field. It still takes energy and attention to take an internal experience, to shape it into words, to form those sounds. And then what happens? You have no idea whether the person hearing those sounds interprets them the same way you do. So you've just gone through all of this effort to communicate something, who knows, probably emotionally vulnerable, or something protective and defensive. And there's no way to know how somebody else receives it. That can be tricky. So we end up doing a lot of assuming that we know what somebody else is talking about. And we do a lot of assuming that they know what we're talking about. That gentleman who said, I'm fine, probably had some idea that I knew what he was talking about. It was a shortcut to not have to say, well, actually, what I'm feeling right now is It was a shortcut to say, I'm focused here. And that's okay. Because we have this ability to imagine, we can make those assumptions about what someone is saying. And because we can imagine someone else's experience, we can imagine that they're imagining that they can understand what we're saying. It is not surprising to me that human communication can be so difficult, especially when emotions are high. Zen brings us something special. Zen brings us the capacity to pay attention to our mind, to pay attention to our body, and to pay attention to our experience in a way that I don't often see in other people I interact with. And I've had many people in the hospital comment to me, you're so attuned, like you really picked up on blah, 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 blah. Like, how do you do that? I don't know. I just sit. I pay attention. I watch. I listen. I try to guess what's going on for this person without putting my experience on them. Zen brings us the capacity to be still with ourselves. Zen brings us the capacity to, at times, respond in a way that is more intimate than that level of language. When we sit together with each other in Sesshin, how many people have had the experience? And if this is not you, that's okay. It's not always me. But how many of you have had the experience of sitting in Sesshin, sitting next to the same person several sitting periods in a row, several days in a row? And when that person who sits next to you comes and sits down, you notice the little sigh. You notice the creak in a knee. Perhaps it's 11:30 and you notice the growling of the stomach. I know what it's like when my stomach growls. I bet there's hunger there. I know what it's like when my knee hurts. This is still taking it back up to the language, even when you're thinking that. But to have that moment of recognition that's underneath words, that's below words, the words don't arise. The mind is still. There's just an awareness of this being, this being, this being, and their experience. Your interpretation might be wrong. So what? I've checked in with people after Sesshin. What was happening? My assumptions have been way off. There are times when my assumptions have been spot on. Who knows? But the important part there was that I wasn't thinking about them. It was just an awareness. Can I share a story about you? Okay.
No.
If he had said no, I would have honored that. Consensus is important. Consent is important. A long time ago, when we were doing a joint retreat out at Great Vow, Takamiya was Tenzo and I was assistant Tenzo. And we sat next to each other in the Zendo and we worked together in the kitchen. So there was a lot of time spent in proximity. And there was one sitting period where I just heard him swallow again and again and again. And this was unlike him. I had that sense of his stillness in Zazen. Just swallow and swallow and swallow. And like, usually that's me and that's what I get self-conscious about. What is this? I couldn't ask him. But it was unusual. It was unusual. We got through that day. We got through the next meal. We got through the night. We got through the next days. I completely forgot about it. End of Sesshin comes. I finally got a chance. What was going on with that? His response, I made lemon bars for dessert. This is a decade and a half. I remember that story. And part of why I remember it, part of why it was so poignant, was one, just that intimacy of sitting, of spending time in proximity, of becoming familiar with like the patterns and rhythms of another person's body in a way that is like, it's not the way we normally become familiar with another person's rhythms and body, right? Zen practice is very different that way. There's an intimacy there that is very grounded, below words. And there's a way we can know each other in this space where words aren't important, where rules aren't important, where we can just be who we are and be with other people as they are. It's very simple. And it's very profound. And it's very difficult for many people to experience. I wish more people could experience. And it's kind of funny because in Zen we have so many words. We have so many stories. We have so many teachings. We have so many koans. The master says this. The student said that. The master says this. The student said that. The master said this. Enlightenment. There's a whole pile of experience there that doesn't ever get put into words. But as we go through our lives, and as we experience practice, as we encounter insight, those little terse, bare outlines of a story can become very rich. Because there is that recognition of humanity, of human experience. I love in our tradition that when we talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, oftentimes we're talking about the person a long time ago who did this practice, who had this life, who wasn't always the most skillful person in his youth, didn't always make the best decisions, but was very heartfelt. And he made decisions and changes in his life to pursue a question of, why do we have some of the experiences that we have? Why does it hurt? Why do we fear? And he really dove into it. And yet, still a person. Gave the same teachings over and over, often changing words. We're back to words, changing words to fit the occasion and to fit his audience. Using words as a tool to help people move towards experience. Trying different words at different times to help people move towards experience. And when we have those moments of connection that goes beyond words, like that is where the heart of empathy and compassion is. And we can talk about that. Empathy and compassion, those are words. Those are ideas. Those are concepts. When the experience arises of having that connection, the heart opens. There is a sense of ease. There is a sense of equanimity. There is a sense of joy. And that moment of connection may be fleeting. We may have that moment of connection and then we put back into that situation where we have to name it. We have a moment of insight and then go to Sanzen and try to put words into an experience that is very hard to describe. And then, at least for me, it feels like I'm fumbling. It's like this, it's sort of like that. There's the sensation. It can be tricky. We go back and forth. Words, experiences, words, connection, grief, sorrow. But this is life. And finally, after 15, 20 years of practice, got a real sense of why Buddhism says the human realm is the best realm, the highest realm, with the most capacity for enlightenment. This human life is precious. What we can do with this life, the way we can meet the world, the way we can meet others, to connect with life in all of its forms, is precious. And yes, it can be hard, and there can be pain, physical pain, emotional pain, psychological pain. And that pain doesn't prevent us from our path. It doesn't prevent us from knowing ourselves. It doesn't prevent us from knowing others. I think I'll stop there for now and take questions and comments. We'll see if any more comes up as the conversation unfolds.
If you're in the sendo, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please say your name before you offer your question or comments and hold the microphone close to your mouth. If you are on Zoom, you can either type your name or your question in the chat box and Tony will unmute you or read the question out for you.
Hi, I'm Guy. Thank you for your talk, Joshin. I've been learning about something that it's funny, maybe is really relevant to this, you know, thinking about death and the finiteness of our individual lives and how we are constantly bombarded with unforeseen conditions and so on. And yet, you know, we have to do some planning and we have to think about future generations. I mean, because we have responsibilities for them. And there's this project called the Clock of the Long Now that it's basically an exercise in getting people to think about future generations and our responsibilities towards them. And it's this clock that's designed to last for, be able to tell time accurately for a period of about 10,000 years, which is about the span of human civilization going back to about the Stone Age, about Neolithic times. And the idea is that you could, we can actually make a clock that can keep accurate time. And it's meant to be able to be maintained by people in the future without the need to rely upon very elaborate high technologies that may be very brittle and may not be available in the future, possibly because of lack of resources or what have you. So it's meant to be something that, you know, could be maintained with Bronze Age techniques. And, you know, just reading about this project and all the thought that went into it and the artistry, and there was something I found really moving about it. I mean, I know there's people who have thought, criticized, well, that's kind of a, you know, highfalutin thing for people of the, you know, luxury class to do. That's just a fun little, you know, a trivial project. But I kind of differed with that because I thought there's a lot of real commitment to the principle of, you know, we have responsibility for the future, and let's think about that. Let's think about, let's not just take for granted that we're going to, you know, trash this planet that we live on and there's not going to be a future. Let's take seriously that there is going to be a future and we have some responsibilities for it, even though we our own individual lives are so finite.
We try to make meaning out of our experiences, and it seems like this project is part of how you're making meaning of your experiences.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
Oren has a question on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Joshin. It's nice to see you.
Hi.
Ever since Dai Guy's talk of a couple weeks ago, I've been pondering a different kind of words. And those are the words that run through our head endlessly, just endlessly. And I realize it's absolutely universal. No one teaches us that. I mean, it can't teach you to think endlessly, quietly in your head, and as Dai Guy said, rehearse what you're going to say. It seems like the Buddhist version of original sin. I don't know, I just can't, you might not have anything to say about it, but it's just, it's interesting to me that we have something very universal and that we have to manage that.
Well, I don't think the words themselves are the problem.
Ah.
I think it's when we put ourselves into the words and like construct our reality through word. Construct our reality through a concept and become detached from experience that we can be caught. Does that make sense?
That's an answer. I'll come back to you in a month and ask you again.
Fair.
Thank you for your answer.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Genko. Back to words and language. I got back recently from the Air American Zen Teachers Association conference, which was lovely. One of the things that they did during the conference was to have a panel on gender issues. Mm. Now, in the past, we have divvied up into a women's group and a men's group. Now that's become increasingly problematic. So we had this panel on gender issues, and it was really a moving situation. I found it really useful. There was a priest who talked about his two transgender daughters, transgender daughters, and he said, "You know, I find it really confusing, and I love them." So underneath all the confusion, there was this really solid sense of love. Mm-hmm. A transgender man said, was talking about the fact that somewhere along the line, there's been this idea that people who protect and defend transgender people are somehow terrorists. And it made me want to get a t-shirt that said, "I protect transgender people." Because I was like, yeah, let me have you a terrorist. I don't know. So I thought, well, I don't know if that even makes any sense to do something like that. So I asked him, I said, "So what would you suggest or want the rest of us to do in terms of protecting and defending and supporting and whatever?" And he thought for a minute and he said, "Be yourself." Mm-hmm. And I thought that what a good answer that is. Just the idea is we're all being our authentic selves, whether we can explain it or not. And I was thinking we need a different language. I don't know if we need a different language. Sometimes I think we need to understand there are things that language can't get to.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. You have any thoughts about that?
Well, what was it like for you engaging in that dialogue?
You know, I have found myself also confused and curious and trying to do my very best to stay open and authentic. And I recognized both of those statements and answers as being ones that I could embrace.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remain open and curious and sometimes confused. So mm-hmm. that's where I'm at. And still making the effort to talk about it, to find words, find language, because the language has changed over the decades, and our sense of how that's supposed to work has changed and is changing, and it's confusing for a lot of people, and some people really have a hard time with it, and I'm doing my very best to simply stay with it.
Yeah, I think language will always change. I think when we feel grounded enough to be our authentic selves, we create an environment in which others also are able to be their authentic selves. And when we lean into this experience of being able to be who we are, it creates an environment where others can be who they are. We're just people. We're all people.
Yes, muddling through, doing the best we can.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Annie Rose. I went out of town to Tacoma for a week because they're remodeling the kitchen. And on the way back, we were going to stop at the zoo. And I just remember getting in the van and I started crying. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, that doesn't make sense. Because when I worked at the zoo, I like the kids. I want to go to the zoo and there's something holding me back. And everybody's in the van cheering and yelling because we're listening to Taylor Swift. And I'm a train wreck. Like, what is going on? And then we get to the zoo, I stopped crying. And it didn't occur to me till I switched the van to a different van. And then when we hit the road, I wasn't crying. It was like, well, what changed? Something changed. And I didn't realize when we went to the record store on the way back, the van door flew open. And we were on the road having to pull over. Everybody's freaking out. I was like, oh my God. And then as soon as I got back in the van afterwards, I'm a train wreck not wanting to hit the road because the door flew open. And even with the seatbelt on, I was still scared, not realizing how scared I was. And I was like, it didn't occur to me it was the door, but like afterwards, it was like halfway home, it was like on the freeway, it was like, it was the door.
It was the door. Yeah, you figured that out. Yeah. That's a great example of tuning into your own experience and noticing as things are arising, leaning into what's actually going on here. Glad you had your seatbelt on.
Yeah. Hi, this is Julie. I was thinking about the guy in the hospital, and I was wondering how you interpreted his statement, I'm fine. Like, was it kind of a sincere, I'm fine, not being fine, I would like some space to feel? Or maybe was it more like a dissociated, I'm fine, like I'm shutting out what's happening?
It was, my interpretation was it's a stressed out, I'm fine. He had gone into the room. There was a respiratory therapist on one side of the bed. There was a stroke nurse on the other side of the bed. He was standing at the foot, watching his wife as they were getting ready to take her down to imaging. And like, he looked at her, he very briefly looked at me, his brow was furrowed, his voice was terse, and it was a very sharp, I'm fine. And like with that, the interpretation was like, I'm here, you're extra, which is fine. Often in that case, people really want to engage with the medical team because they want to know what's happening and they want to know, is my person going to be okay? Everything else is extra at that point. This is not the time for a long conversation. Like later on, when I was writing my chart note, I could see some of what might be behind that, I'm fine. And like that family came from a marginalized religious community. And so part of it might've been just like, I'm holding boundaries and protecting my family from whatever assumption he put on me about whatever comes with the word chaplain, which can be a loaded word for people. And I trust, even though I knew he was still upset, I trust he has what he needs to support himself to get through this.
Thank you. I was feeling very sympathetic towards him in that story.
Yeah. 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 I saw him later in the cafeteria and he had another person with him. So he had a support person with him.
This is Tony. I can wait. It's all right.
This is Amy. I think my question concerns what you mentioned around being very aware, like helping you be more aware of other people's, like very attuned, I guess is the word. But my question is for those of us who are like, have a problem with that, or it's like hyper attunement or like constant, like it's a thing pre-Zen, whatever that you had, maybe, and that's like the problem.
A little bit of hypervigilance.
Yeah, or just like, I don't have the words, but yeah, like just being overly concerned with other people's experience and knowing the difference between being attuned and like connected in a healthy way versus like using this, like filling the space with concerns around of the other people around you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that can be tricky at times. And like it helps to get feedback from other people. It helps to have somebody you trust to talk over your experiences with. And it helps to get feedback from folks that you're interacting with. I think some of what I've been talking about in terms of how Zen practice can shape how we perceive the world and how we perceive others and ourselves. It's an ongoing practice. It's an ongoing interrogation of our own experiences. So knowing, like each person knowing their own way of they respond to the world helps, and watching how that changes over time and with practice helps. Because it becomes easier to distinguish this is a reactive response versus this is coming from a genuine place of curiosity and care. This is coming from a fear response. This is coming from a grounded, open-handed reaching out.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Tony. I have a question, or maybe just a comment really, about the difficulty of communicating, where the difficulty in communicating in the world largely arises from is that we're not in a position to have this other communication with people, that in so many situations there are only words, right? And you know, even as simple difference between being in my house and being at work, I mean, you have something like a faculty meeting and tempers are high and everybody has an opinion. And this is a kind of hyper wordy situation, as you can imagine. And
it's not a good venue for Zen practice.
No, but it's the world.
Yeah.
And it's most of the world. I mean, politics is that to the max, right? That's even just local politics. Then there's national politics. Then there's international politics. Words on words on words. All the translations. And in almost all of those situations, you're not sitting down next to someone. And even when you are, I can tell from faculty meetings, actually the counterintuitive thing is we've gone over to all Zoom meetings, and that actually works better because when we're all in the room and we can feel each other's, you know, sense of angst, it's worse. It's actually worse. So what on earth do we do about that globally as humanity? I mean, is there any way around that?
Well, I think the only thing we can do about it is notice the self that we bring into that environment and notice how we engage with that environment.
Yes.
If I'm not ever in faculty meetings, but if I'm in a union bargaining meeting and tensions are running high and there's a lot of people talking over each other, part of what I do is really hone in on what is this being doing right now? Am I adding to the tension and the frustration? Am I simply listening, and or am I checked out? And it's different. All we can do is bring who we are to the moment. And sometimes in that moment, I'm shouting to be heard. Sometimes in the moment, I'm listening. And sometimes in the moment, I'm trying to ask a question to get clarity.
What do you do with the sense that, oh my God, it's all far too much? How can I make the slightest bit of difference here? Right.
Notice when you're overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Notice when it's too much. And notice what you do in response to that.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Large groups of people are not my funnest place. Present company accepted? Included? I'm not sure. Thank you, Tony.
Hi, this is Maya. First of all, I want to express my gratitude and appreciation. So I'm kind of a circular talker. I wanted to give you. So first of all, what I thought about is when I went snorkeling, the idea of when I, you know, looked out on the ocean, it just looked like a flat ocean. And then when I went down with my snorkel on, then it was an entire different world. And what I saw was different than what my 9-year-old nephew saw, and different than my sister, and different than my niece, and even or my daughter. And even though Etsu, my daughter, tried to show me what she was seeing, I couldn't see it because, you know, underwater. And in my work, I do foster care review cases, so child abuse, neglect. But recently, I've stumbled upon. I now know, and it's a rabbit hole, and you guys can tell me to stop because I'm really passionate about this now. But I've discovered that there's a lot of nonverbal people who are unable to talk because they're not provided the right support and communication device. But once they are, oh my gosh, it's like that surface water and going underneath. They have all this to say and all this going on. And in my rabbit hole, like I talked to a trial lawyer who's now a pastor of special needs kids. And he says, one of his parishioners said, I don't like cartoons. I want to learn about history, you know, and then we had a presenter because of this rabbit hole. We had a presenter come, and Nico, he told us that up until 11, everyone thought, you know, there was nothing in there until his mom found him the letter board and gave him the supports. And then all of a sudden he's this prolific poet and, you know, so intelligent. And so I just wanted to share that about the communication. And then looping back to heartfelt gratitude to Genko, I recently went through a tremendous life change. But coming here for a year before that life change, I truly believe it was a dharma. And that was something that I could not put to words that helped me see something that I totally was blind to. But then once I saw it, and again, it was something I cannot put to words, but it helped me. And it helped me actually make that change. And again, Genko, thank you. She took my calls, even on her days off. But just all of those things with language. And for me, it's really making me question, like in my own personal life, I just was blind to certain things. And then now at work, I'm realizing, oh my gosh, so much of us are blind. This foster kid who is, you know, flipping out because of a pair of scissors, maybe it's because he can't actually talk and no one's giving him the supports. And then how do I communicate that in a way so people will be open to it?
Yeah.
And because there's a lot of resistance because, you know, they're all like, Maya, no, he can talk to me, you know, whatever. But it's just like all these layers. But again, but to your talk, respectfully, I so agree. The times I've sat, and I just want to say about 10 and a half years ago, I was a resident at Great Vow when Hakumio was Tenzo. So I may have been there that time.
You might have had the lemon bars.
But in that era of my life too, being a resident really helped me. That dharma helped me make a tremendous shift in my life. And again, I can't put words to that dharma. Yeah. So thank you.
I don't think we can ever truly understand another's experience, but we certainly put a lot of effort into trying. I've never snorkeled, so my imagination came up with all sorts of like what this must be like, which I'm sure doesn't even touch your memories of your experience. But even though there's not shared experience, we still try to understand each other. We're social people. We like to connect. And thank you for working to help people express themselves.
Hi, this is Kristen. Thanks for the talk. Just hearing people's responses, comments, I feel like I'm hearing a common thread, and it's something that I struggle with too, but of like discomfort and frustration arising from not understanding someone's response or who somebody is. Like, I'm like specifically from Genko's comment and Tony's, like, and yeah, I experience that all the time. You know, if I'm in a conversation with somebody and I just don't get their logic, right? Or I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
And it's a problem. It's a problem because, you know, anger arises and it's, and then it's like not accepting them, not accepting who they are. And then all of the fallout from that. And yeah, just thinking about it, like maybe that's contriving reality for the self or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, maybe if you have thoughts on that issue.
I think it's a common experience getting frustrated with people because you don't understand where they're coming from. And I don't have an easy fix, an easy response, other than I wonder what the world would be like if we could slow down and take the time to actually.
Yeah, like the assumption that you should understand everything, you should understand who somebody is exactly, you should understand everything, is like I act from that assumption and mm-hmm. react to the world from that assumption, mm-hmm. but it's really kind of stupid to think that way. Like, why would you understand everybody? Why would you, you know, that doesn't make any sense, really.
There's the why would I, but there's also like, this is what we're culturally conditioned to do. So don't beat yourself up too hard. I think that's how people interact in many of our societies. And I hear so often, there's not enough time, I have too many things to do, there's so much on my plate, that sense of coming from a place of lack flavors how we interact with others. And it may be different to start from a sense of abundance, of we do have time, and I'm not really understanding where you're coming from. Like, tell me more about this side or the other. It might make things different. I got time for one or two more.
Hello, my name is Haley.
Hello.
I'm still interested in that, where you're talking about, like, here, there was this, like, clearly distressing event with the guy with saying I'm fine, and mm-hmm. his wife is clearly in danger and stuff like that. And I just makes me think of like kind of like social issues in general, where it's like you don't know whether to like address people's words or the things that they're non-verbally sending to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many times where it's like and it's hard to like figure that out from like what they're non-verbally saying to you or noise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this person not getting back to me because they have a dentist appointment, or are they not getting back to me because they're trying to send me a message that I am being too much? Mm-hmm. Like, or I feel like there's just like so many things, like they clearly seem stressed, but then they're like, oh yeah, I'm fine. Like, I don't know. There's mm-hmm. like, there's so many things that are unsaid. And one of the things that came to me too is like, say the difference between like, say being queer, like having identities versus say before you have an identity, like everyone knows but they don't tell you, and everyone mm-hmm. is reacting to you in a way that makes no sense until you find out that like, oh, everyone thinks that you're gay and you don't even know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it just and it's years worth of just like everyone responding and you're like, huh?
Yeah.
That's what people were doing. I don't know. That's why people were acting weird. Like, I don't know. So yeah. I'm just interested in that, like, how do you bridge the verbal and the nonverbal world, and like how people don't really talk about their experiences, they just perceive it. I don't know.
Yeah, it can be tricky because there are those times when people communicate one thing in words and then their body language is communicating something completely different. One of the things that may help, and you can experiment with this, is ask clarifying questions.
Okay.
Or make observations.
Okay.
Like, wow, your brow was furrowed when you said that. I'm worried that you're upset when you're telling me you're fine. Like, what's going on there?
I noticed there's like a lot like the opposite too, that like people read things off me and I don't realize it. Like yeah. Sometimes I realize that people are acting different and then yeah. I realize, oh, it's probably something like maybe I'm not making eye contact or I wasn't like smiling at them, and that's probably what they're responding on.
Yeah. And an important thing to remember is people don't always understand their own experiences.
Right.
They don't understand what shapes their faces are making or how yeah. their body's standing. Which just adds to the, sometimes I don't understand my own experience.
Yeah.
And it can be hard to communicate. So even when we ask clarifying questions, we might not get a satisfactory answer.
Right.
But even asking is moving from a place of wanting to clarify mm-hmm. and gain insight, as opposed to making blind assumptions or pure reactivity.
Right.
Does that help at all?
I think so.
Okay. All righty. Are we good for now? Are we complete?